a little nervous, and I hope that I've kind of been able to organize my thoughts in a way that's understandable and hopefully helpful. But my name is Robin, and I am powerless to food. I'm a binge eater. I am a compulsive overeater. I am an emotional eater, and I'm a food addict. I've eaten food that's spoiled, that's dirty from the trash, that I've stolen, that I've hoarded, that I've sneaked, and I perpetually position myself for the corner piece and any extra icing that could be attained. I just wanted to kind of share my history, and I'm guessing a lot of us probably have some points in common, but I came from what was considered a good home. We were a good home because, you know, my parents were together. They both worked full-time jobs. They didn't drink and they didn't do drugs. We never asked for anything. We were the salt of the earth, hardworking people. And that's how we were thought to think of ourselves. And within that, there was the control and oppression and authoritarian just culture of our household. And that included violence. It was a very explosive violence. My sister and I, we just walked on eggshells. We were very much seen and not heard children. And food was always part of that. Asking for the food, food that you couldn't have, you know, what food was acceptable for you? What was just, you know, my father's or my mother's food? My sister and I started cooking dinner at a very young age, like 7 or 8. And so there was punishment around food too. So if you burnt the dinner, you were probably going to get spanked. If you ate the food that was for his lunch bucket, you were going to get spanked. So there was always a control around food and just that culture of violence and oppression. And I don't mean to say that my parents were all bad, but I do accept these things just as part of my makeup and part of their makeup too. So I never learned a lot of coping skills. I never really learned how to build connections. Dieting started early. The first time I was put on a diet was at 8 years old. My sister and I, her more so, were being picked on. And so we were put on Slim Fast at 8, but this was the 80s. So anything went in the 80s, I suppose. We ate breakfast and lunch and then had a shake for dinner. What I remember about that was not that I wanted to be thin. What I remember is my parents, and I hope it's okay that I'm sharing specific foods, but my parents eating regular, and it was like pizza night, and it was like homemade pizza night. And I remember my mom serving that up for them and just that intense longing for that food. And these are my most vivid memories of childhood, as feelings of longing and want. The first time that I found restricting, so the first time that I viewed food in a different way other than punishment or comfort, was around 12. So that's just a formative year for every little person. And that was the year that I really became aware of myself and my body. I became aware of my family and our weight problem. And I began restricting at that age. This continued for most of my life as I grew up. Again, I just never learned coping skills. I didn't learn how to build connections with people. I just always fell back into that seen and not heard. Acceptable emotions were always anger and bitterness. And bitterness and anger can always be numbed with food. I became a fixer and substitute of solid connections. So I would connect myself to someone who needed help. And that was typically other people with addictions. So most of my 20s, I was with men who were alcoholics, though I wasn't an alcoholic and I didn't drink. My best friend from 15 to 30 was an opioid addict. I found myself serving in women's addiction ministry. So like a halfway house for women with addiction. And I always put myself with these people with addiction. And I would say things like, I just get it. Like, it's just so crazy how connected I feel to addiction when I don't have an addiction. Like, that's insane. I would just gravitate towards these people and I was going to fix them. I didn't per se need fixing because I didn't have a recognizable addiction. What I would call the depth and breadth of my addiction. And when I went to describe this, I thought of one time my husband and I, we went to the ocean or the Gulf. I don't know if that's technically the ocean, but in Gulfport, Mississippi. And it was a hot day. And the water is just like incredibly calm there. And you just want to go out and you want to be immersed in the water. But we got in the water and we're just like walking and walking and walking. And we're the farthest I've ever been from the beach in my whole life. And still the water only made it up to my knees. And that is the same as my addiction. It was as far as I could see, but it was only so deep. There was only this much to it. In my 20s, I had become really, really good at restricting and starving myself. And I was never not hungry, but I was just good at starving for a long time. And so that for me had become the bar of success. If I could just get back to that being good at starving, then I was successful and I was worthwhile. And what that evolved into was, you know, shorter and shorter cycles of starving and binging. During those cycles, I tried, you know, a million different things. I tried juice cleanses. I tried intermittent fasting, which quickly just became, you know, binge at 4 o'clock. I tried laxatives. I aspired to be bulimic, but as God would have it, I do not have a gag reflex. And it doesn't matter how far I put a toothbrush down my throat, nothing's coming up. So one of those small blessings that you're not thankful for at the time. I was so enmeshed in my own disease and my own food. I built other people's lives around my disease, not only my husband and my children, but one of the craziest things that I can see now is how I took my friend group into this disease with me. I had what I called sanity days, so I could eat whatever I wanted on sanity days. So obviously, my friends needed to get together on the days that I could eat whatever I wanted, because what is the point of being with people if you're not numbing yourself at the same time? Like, looking back, I'm not embarrassed, but I'm just so flabbergasted by even calling it a sanity day when it is like the epitome of insanity in my disease. I have tracked my weight for so long in my life that the weight graph looks like a heartbeat. Like every year I can see like the rally of restricting. And then I can see the just effort, desperation, and the weight going back up. And then like the little P wave and the Q wave and whatever. And then at the very next year, you'll see the same heartbeat over and over and over. And that was the shallowness of my disease. I was desperate for an answer. And, you know, I grew up without the internet, and the internet was definitely part of my disease because it provided me tools for restricting. It gave me ideas on basically how to harm myself with food. But in the end, you know, I was constantly Googling, like, what is wrong with me? What is this hole? What is this insatiable hunger? And I, you know, you Google insatiable hunger and this like Prader-Willi syndrome comes up. I'm sure other people have Googled it. And it's so dumb that you're sad not to have something so permanent. But I just wanted an answer. I wanted a name to it. I imagined that my mouth was connected to some kind of black hole because I'm a visual person. And I imagined like I just had like this beast within me. And within my visual creative soul, I imagined this beast and I felt like, you know, I don't have a name for what's wrong with me. I'm going to name this beast. And this is one of the most ridiculous things I've done and to admit, but I named my beast because I felt if I could name it, I could control it. So I gave it the name Monstro, which is the whale from Pinocchio, if you were wondering, because that's what I felt like. I just had like this huge thing in front of inside me and I was going to starve it. I realized by this point that I couldn't get rid of this beast within me, this hole of darkness, but maybe I could starve it into hibernation. And that didn't work either. Eventually, my Googling started to turn up food addiction and eating disorders. And then this brings me to what I consider the barriers to abstinence. For me, these are the two basic barriers that I had to abstinence that I needed to overcome. The first one was ignorance. I was ignorant. I had a lack of knowledge. And at the same time, I had too much knowledge about addiction. I thought that I knew what addiction was. I had always been around it. I had served. I had helped. I had grieved the people that I loved. And I had grieved their addictions and what it did to my life and their life. Never acknowledging that I was living in that addiction and I was living out those same behaviors that I was trying to fix in them. The second biggest barrier to me was imposter syndrome. I didn't feel I could claim the term addiction, and I also didn't feel I could claim the term eating disorder. The reason being is in my warped brain, I considered eating disorders successful. If you were anorexic or bulimic and you were small and you were successful at it, and my body did not show those signs and symptoms. So I had a hard time accepting that, yes, this is addiction and yes, this is eating disorder. The last barrier to abstinence for me was my perception of God. I grew up knowing that there was a God. The God for me is one God. But my perception of God was very much colored by the household that I'd grown up in. My father was a protector. My father was a provider. But my father was also a punisher and violent. And so these perceptions were also God to me. And I didn't trust God. And I had a fear of answered prayers. I'd prayed many things in my life and I had many unanswered prayers. But I felt like when I did get an answered prayer, that I paid for it. When I prayed for a healthy child and a miracle, I got one. And then that was followed by a long bout of colic that lasted past 6 months and postpartum depression and anxiety. And I remember praying to God, like, why did you bring us through? Why did you bring us through into life just to make us suffer? I mistrusted God because he answered my prayer for a restored marriage. I prayed for my marriage to be restored because I knew something was wrong. And then the answer to that was for my marriage to be completely torn apart, to be rebuilt. I had got what I prayed for, and I felt like I was paying for it, or that I had to be legalistic with God and find the perfect prayer, like, please restore my marriage without causing X, Y, and Z. You know, please give me the easiest healthy baby that you can manage that sleeps through the night before they're 3 years old. Those weren't the case. The point that I came to abstinence, I had to be desperate. I had to have tried everything within my power, within my plotting, sneaking brain to try. I very clearly remember the feeling that I was doing a good job hiding what was going on with me, because I had started to realize that this was a disease. And I was vaguely aware of OA, but I had gone to the zoo with my friends and our kids, and I felt like I was hiding. And then, you know, people post pictures, and I looked at those pictures and I thought my clothes were big enough. And I thought I had positioned my children in front of me to the right place where people would not see the shameful thing that I had done to myself and my body. But it was obvious, and I felt exposed, and I felt ashamed, and I felt embarrassed, and I felt helpless and hopeless and still distrusting of God. But I was so helpless and hopeless that I was going to give God a chance. I was sitting in the chair with my little one-year-old daughter, and I said, I'm going to do this. I'm going to give God 90 days. I'm going to give them 90 days and we'll see what happens. And I did. I submitted. I gave them 90 days. That's all I had to do. I was not giving God forever. So I gave up things that I never thought I would give up, because I was always a negotiator of calories. So even if I was starving, if I was eating like just, you know, a few hundred calories a day, I could eat whatever I wanted in those calories. So in this food plan of submitting to God, which was the very first step, I submitted to a food plan that was not of my making. So I wasn't going to negotiate it. I wasn't going to manipulate it. I wasn't going to haggle. And I was going to give up wheat and sugar. And those had always sounded previously just ridiculously impossible to give up. The evolution of my abstinence is an ongoing thing, but I'm just going to talk about that evolution so far and what this abstinence has meant for me. First things that I did was I started attending meetings online. I found a great meeting that happens every night at 9 p.m. And one of those first meetings, I heard connections are the opposite of addiction. I had no idea. Like, I had never heard that. I had been to AA meetings. I had been to NA meetings with people, and I had never heard this. And it was just like looking at the sun. It was like a bright light went off in my head. The only connections that I ever made with people were providing a service to them. So if I was helpful, I was connected to them. Laughter has and always been a wonderful feeling of connection. If people are laughing at your joke, then in that moment, you're connected. And sex, you know, when you are with someone, totally with them, you're connected. But both all of those things, as soon as they're over, the connection is broken. It's not lasting. And it's still shallow like the golf. So I needed to start actually feeling connections with people. And I very quickly started telling everyone around me that I was a food addict and that I was in recovery. And I also, at the same time, had to very much accept that I did not need anyone else's validation to be in recovery. I'm so thankful that I don't need anyone to acknowledge that I have an eating disorder for me to acknowledge it, to accept it, and to accept my recovery as well. Because if I did, I would fail. The first time someone rolled their eyes when I said, I'm a food addict, I'm in recovery, I would have been off the edge. I learned that there is problems with abstinence, but those problems aren't with food or with the abstinence, they're life. So it's just basically being a person. And without food, I have to have emotions. I'm not constantly numbed. I don't have a go-to solution. And to be honest, it feels like a midlife crisis. I don't know who the F I am, and I'm figuring it out day by day. I started out my life as I don't ask anyone for anything. I don't need anything. I'm low maintenance. I don't get sad. I don't get upset to like, holy crap, I'm a romantic person and I'm fucking needy. I need a lot of interaction and affection and attention, and it's okay to want and need those things because I'm a person and I'm a loving person. So much of my life thought that I, and I'm going to cuss a little bit here because this is just the way I think of things, like, but I really, so much of my life felt like I was swimming in a sea of assholes. Like, I just always felt like, what is wrong with people? Like, I'd find good people and I'd be like, yeah, like I found an awesome person, but there's still a sea of assholes out there. But now, and in this connection, in this openness, I'm like, I meet the best people everywhere I go. I went to this toy store the other day and I find myself talking to the little, you know, 20 something sales lady about ADD and depression and all of these parts of life that we're just recovering and thriving in. Everywhere I go, I meet a wonderful person and I make a connection now. For me, sharing is a huge part of recovery. I like to say I keep my garbage in the front. So if you talk to me, you're going to hear about my baggage. It's not to put it on you. It's just because I'm sharing now. I had to learn positive self-talk very quickly. If I am a worthless piece of shit, it is not worth planning a meal. If I am worthless, then it's not worth packing the food that I need to take with me somewhere. So I very much had to learn, you don't have to eat the food off the floor. There's more food out there. I don't grieve a grain of rice anymore. For my abstinence to keep going, I needed to accept imperfection. I accept the spirit of my abstinence. If I accidentally have something with sugar or weed in it, was it intentional? Did I fall? Or is it just something that happened and I can plan differently next time? Do I not like the way I feel after a decision? So maybe I made a bad decision. I have made bad decisions. That doesn't mean that my abstinence is destroyed. It means that I'm learning from those mistakes and I'm accepting them as part of my evolution of abstinence. Obviously, there's been improved health with my abstinence. I no longer have constant unbearable GERD. I'm no longer constantly constipated. My body is able to move. My body is not in pain constantly. I can buy clothes this month and those clothes fit next month, which is just crazy because half the stress of everyday life was like, oh, what clothes am I going to have to put on? And this constant looming dread. Like, I can't go enjoy time with people because I'm going to have to find something decent to put on my body. Also, physically, when I started abstinence, I felt like I felt like there needed to be a book called Eating for Dummies. Truly physically eating for dummies. Like, put one bite in your mouth, chew the bite, swallow the bite, think about the flavor, and then swallow the bite. And I would talk to myself like this. Well, and I did it like for a long time. Sometimes if I feel like I'm starting to eat fast, I go back to my like eating for dummies script. Smell the food. Like, do you like this food? You don't like this food. Don't eat the food. That's honestly what it felt like. Sometimes I say these things to my kids because I don't want them to wait till they're 40 to figure out you should only eat things that your body wants and your body needs and that you should chew. So I have found that the freedom from food obsession has left so much room for a life of growth, a life of connections, a life of love, a life that includes sadness. It includes hope. I accept that I have depression and that I'm going to be medicated my whole life. And I am so happy with the fact that I have that knowledge and that I don't have to struggle with it anymore. 546 days ago, I accepted a miracle and I have chosen to accept that miracle every day since. It wasn't one miracle that just kept going. It was a million little choices of accepting help, of accepting connection. I understand that not everybody counts the days of their abstinence, that some people live in the minute or the hour or the day or the month. But for me, I am stacking my days and I love the number because I look back at the whole life before and all of those days were colored and shaped by this disease and loneliness. And even if I lose my abstinence tomorrow, these 546 days are mine. They have been a life of feeling and connection and love. When I look back on these 546 days, I don't think about the shame of hoarding Easter candy in the basement. I don't think about how great that birthday cake was. I remember my children singing the song, and I'm very grateful for that. And I'm grateful for this meeting, and I'm grateful for all the people of OA. And with that, I'll pass.